Oh, the shape that will get. If you let all the fans down.
Can we not lock it?
It's a fact. I'm not playing mind games. I'm talking about facts.
I always said if I was Aladici, I would probably say I was more of a tactical genius.
The answer questions on anything. Religious, politics, health, you know, sexual problems.
Look at his face! Just look at his face!
None of you, except for those two, have done anything to justify the money that you earn. None of you! Disgrace!
And I suggest you shut up and show more football.
All right, you're very welcome along to Team 33 and a call here with you for the next hour or so. Coming up on tonight's show, we will be continuing our LOI Legend series. We're into episode 6 now, and we're going to be chatting to Finn Harps legend and all-time top goalscorer in the League of Ireland, Brendan Bradley. So that's coming up a little later on. We've had a lot of football news over the last couple of weeks, some movement in the leagues across Europe. PSG have officially been crowned League One champions, but that is not the biggest news of the week. The biggest news of this week is that Oasis have released a new song. Noel Gallagher found it in his mansion somewhere, along with a load of different songs that they've recorded through the years that have never been released. Don't Stop. And I personally think it's okay. It's bang average in my opinion. But there's one key factor that's missing. Liam Gallagher does not feature. Does that surprise you, Colin Buig?
Not in the slightest bit, Endicott. That Liam Gallagher does not feature. Listen, Noel Gallagher undoubtedly has countless songs in his back room from his Oasis days, demos that never saw the light of day, which I assume feature Liam Gallagher and the original gang. They're plentiful in supply. But instead, Noel Gallagher has gone for a Noel-only acoustic and he's released it. I was completely purposeful. And the first line of the song, "Bye bye, my friend, I'm leaving." And unlike what he said in the Oasis official message on their social media accounts on Wednesday, Noel was saying that he found this, you know, just rummaging around and he thinks it's from 15 years ago. It's actually from April 2009, a sound check there. So if you know your dates about Oasis, that's right on the eve of their split. It's completely pointed, and Liam Gallagher has responded in kind on social media. Fantastic.
Yeah, and we're joined by another Oasis superfan, I'm told. Paul Muir, how are you getting on?
Not too bad, lads. I'm sure Colm's, when he heard the news, I would love to have been in the room at the time. I'd say your head probably hit the ceiling, you'd probably jump for joy. But it's an interesting point that Liam, as we all expected, as soon as it was released, took to Twitter, as he always does. Curious that we all knew he was going to instantly hate it because that's just in his nature. But he did say that he didn't regard it as an Oasis song, not just only because he's not on it, but because Gwigs and Bonehead isn't on it too. And for anyone who's sort of followed Liam's career in the last while, you know just how close Liam and Bonehead seem to be. And obviously, since Oasis split, Bonehead is very much in camp Liam. But just on the release itself, it's very interesting because unlike Liam's Twitter, Noel, you can tell Noel doesn't handle his. It's very corporate. It's very PR driven. And the wording of it, he said, we thought we'd put it out. So even I'm micro picking every small detail here. So I'm curious who Noel ran this by. And looking at the stage, the version of it that was in the sound check, as Colm said, that would have been around, I think he said about 15 years. So I kind of looked up the set list and stuff like that. So at the time they were in Hong Kong, it was, and there was seven, on that gig, Don't Believe the Truth records. So that's kind of the time you're looking around then. So yeah, this is the time when Noel, I think in the last three Oasis records, he has three lead vocals on the tracks on Heat and Chemistry, on Don't Believe the Truth, and Dig Out Your Soul. So this is very much the time when Noel is kind of taking lead vocals, and as anyone who saw Supersonic, that just does not sit right with Liam at all. And there's loads of different reasons, but that was one of Liam's really big gripes with Noel at that time.
I was actually going to mention the announcement itself and the wording, exactly the wording and the way that Noel runs his Twitter account compared to Liam. And over the last couple of years, there's a massive shift in Noel fans and Liam fans, and it's very much now it's all Liam. He's the more popular one. People see Noel as the corporate one, the one who essentially broke up Oasis. And I think Supersonic did a fair share of that damage as well. Colin, where do you stand on that? Do you think people are starting to favour Liam over Noel a bit more now over the last couple of years because of the way he seems more personable and approachable?
Yeah, undoubtedly. I wrote an article about this a few years ago about how the dynamic changed as the 2010s progressed. And for the first half of that decade, Noel had the place to himself. And everybody thought this guy was a godlike genius, as he was voted in 2012. So he had the talent. He was thriving with the High Flying Birds. And he had the humour and he had people in stitches. And at one stage, people thought he should just give up the music and go to comedy because he was so funny. And in the meantime, Liam was nowhere to be seen after the inevitable demise of BDI. He had personal issues going on behind the scenes. So it looked like we had seen the last of Liam. And Noel seemed to delight in that. And then out of nowhere, middle of the last decade, Liam is seen in that Mayo pub strumming acoustic guitar and people are like, Jesus, yeah, Liam Gallagher. And 5 years later, he is once again the main attraction of unofficial Oasis band. And the thing with Liam is that like Liam Gallagher must be the most relatable middle-aged man for young people ever, because there's a whole legion of new fans that obviously weren't around when Oasis were in their zenith. And Liam has taken to social media like a duck to water. And with that, he has brought a huge new cohort of young fans that Noel isn't really that bothered about. And as Paul said, Noel's social media accounts are very corporate. That's not Noel's thing. Whereas Liam is a man of the people, in inverted commas. And as a result, the dynamic has shifted so much in the last 10 years towards Liam. And what I find really interesting about Don't Stop is that, like, Noel Gallagher obviously wrote the song, and I presume legally he owns it as well. So he could have easily released this as a High Flying Bird song if he wanted to. He could have just re-recorded this song and it could be a new High Flying Bird song. But no, it's an Oasis song and it's released on the Oasis social media channels. Of course, yeah. Liam was going to listen. And of course, Liam was going to say what he said.
It's interesting there that Noel... if anyone's following the Tim Burgess Twitter parties, they're great on Twitter, and Bonehead is very active. He did Be Here Now recently. And Noel Gallagher, for all his flaws, as we all know, very public, he is a man that has a very clear vision for songs. I mean, I think everyone knows he was the person that drove that band. But it's interesting with All Around the World they're talking about. If anyone saw Supersonic, I think it's the first footage you see of them in the boardwalk, them just throwing out the chorus there, that Bonehead, when he was taking part in the Twitter party, said that Noel sat on that song for, Jesus, that must be what?
5 years.
God knows how long, yeah. Until he got it perfect, because he wanted the orchestra, he wanted the orchestra with it. He had a very clear vision for this song. So like Noel, the timing of this is not coincidental at all. Noel will only release stuff when it suits him, basically. Mm. If he wouldn't throw out anything if he didn't think it was decent, or maybe to make a point. And as you said, the fact that it is basically Noel doing playing guitar himself, Noel lead vocals. And I we were talking about this before, I wouldn't have it as the best Noel Gallagher song in Oasis. And by that, I mean him on vocals, but it's far, far from being his worst. I'd have it somewhere middle category. But Noel is a methodical person about this sort of stuff.
Noel has a penchant for being poignant, doesn't he? Because there's a lyric in Don't Stop called Don't Stop, You're Clapping. And every Thursday at the moment of Britain, people are applauding the NHS. So and it's this uplifting message. I mean, when I first heard it on Wednesday night, I was initially ambivalent because I think I might have texted Paul or even you, and I can't remember who I texted, but I said, I thought Get By with a Little Help from My Friends. It was just the image of it. It was exactly the same chord progression. So it was another homage to the Beatles or Joe Cocker. And so I thought, oh, this is just like a Beatles song. And I've listened to it so often in the meantime. And I think what it will be is it's going to be my song of the lockdown because I've listened to it so much. And for me, it's like a perfect kind of morning after where you're on a sun holiday and you're sitting on the beach and you're a bit worse for wear. And you just throw this in and it's very relaxing and you can fall asleep again. And then later on in the day, when you go at it again, you start with this as you're sipping a beer in the porch looking out. I think it's a great tune. Fantastic.
Go. We got Sound of the Summer. Sound of the Lockdown is a new category.
And you don't agree, no?
I think it has definitely gotten better every time I listen to it.
Yeah.
But I initially, like, what I love about Oasis and some of the songs that they released over there, and I realize that not every song can be like what I'm about to describe, but they just grab you by the balls. Like, the music, the lyrics, everything is just in your face. And then Noel gets on the guitar, and I just think it's a little bit soppy, a little bit sad. And he's just thriving in the fact that everyone's listening to him and him only, and he's center stage. And that for me is what this song screams. And that's what he's trying to do at the minute, is that he can see that Liam's getting attention. He can see that in the Twitter spats about his, Liam has had some very, very strong things to say about him and his wife. So people are still siding with Liam slightly. And this is his way of getting out and saying, you know what, I was the main man in Oasis, and if it wasn't for my lyrics and my musical ability, none of that would have happened.
Yeah, and also, like, bear in mind, right, this was either written during Don't Believe the Truth, which is 2005, or their last album, Dig Out Your Soul, 2008. It's one or the other. They're two bang average albums. I mean, every Oasis fan will tell you that. And their lead songs, like, probably out of the two albums, The Importance of Being Idle is the best song, probably. And that's a decent song. It's nothing better.
Chocolate Alive, it's not bad.
Yeah, it's okay. Yeah, but I mean, it's not. Yeah, but that's Dig Out Your Soul, and that's a bang average album. Really bad. Whereas Don't Believe the Truth has its moments. But like, Noel, right, decided that this song, Don't Stop, wasn't even good enough for a B-side on those two albums. So that's another way, and of him saying now, 15 years later, or 10 years, whatever it is, he's coming out and saying, I didn't even put this as a B-side on two of the worst Oasis albums, and it's still a bit of a tune. Like, that's what I can do. Like, that's what I, you know, I can, I just pull these songs out of my arse. Like, these are so easy for me to do. Not like your man over there, who's just singing my songs to this day.
Which is weird, because like, Noel's songs on those last two albums, like She Is Love and Mucky Fingers, they're like terrible. They're one, some of the worst Oasis songs I remember. And when Noel wants to be, shocking. I genuinely think with those type of songs, Andy, you were saying, you know, the emotive ones, like, you look at the back catalogue, like Oasis were always great at sort of get you up on your feet Friday night stuff, but it's always the introspective stuff. Like, and Noel's at the, obviously he writes them, but his voice just, it's completely different to Liam's, in that I'm not saying Liam can't do those kind of introspective, tender kind of emotive songs, because we've seen the performance of like Don't Go Away, and even Slide Away, I'd argue is a very emotional song in that. But like, you look at Noel, Talk Tonight, Sad Song, Half the World Away, The Master Plan, Going Nowhere, you know, these are all those sort of kind of songs you put on, like, as Colin said, 2 a.m. in the morning when you're just sort of gathering your thoughts. Like, Noel Gallagher's voice, and there might be that connection of songwriter to performer that just kind of lifts them up that little bit more. Like, he has this in his locker, which kind of goes back to Colin's point. I'm astounded why he didn't think this one was good enough for the last two albums, unless it would have been, as Colin said, maybe wanted to hold it for, maybe he's thinking already about High Flying Birds, maybe he just couldn't be arsed.
But yeah, it's mad. But I'd say, just one more thing. It's mad. This is already approaching 1 million views on the Oasis YouTube channel 24 hours after going up. If this was released at the time, no one would care about it. That probably sums up the song.
And also it's kind of the same music as well, I guess, is that just that
the
nostalgia will never go away. And, you know, like, in fairness to Liam, he's always been upfront about the idea of a reunion. He said his bags are packed, and I think Bonehead is very much in that as well. So despite all the animosity, Liam, I think, would go tomorrow if he could, but whether that happens is a different thing, because Noel does not seem to be moving on that at all.
Well, on the main sort of the upfront thing about it is Noel clearly doesn't want to be part of Oasis, but again, if you're looking at it from, maybe I'm digging too far into it, but Liam, who has always said he will get Oasis back together, or he's ready to do it, as Paul, you said there, he, for this NHS gig coming up, whenever they're available to do it, Oasis are going to play at it, regardless of whether Noel is there or not. I think Gwigs is in for it. Bonehead's definitely up for it. And it'll probably be, if Noel doesn't turn up, it'll be Richard Ashcroft that's going to perform alongside them. I would gather there's going to be Richard Ashcroft that does it. But we could be in for a surprise Noel appearance. Who knows? Maybe this is just, maybe throwing this out there, see what reaction it gets, see if there's an audience there still for Oasis.
Yeah, it would be a great one-off gig. It would be amazing. Like, think of the emotion if just those two lads were on stage together nowadays, because you can picture them, what they both look like now or what they both act like now. Just having them on the same stage would be electric. But I personally, like, I don't think there's any need to have a reunion overall, though. I just would just leave it as it was. Because, like, think of the Stone Roses lads. Like, the Stone Roses came back there a few years ago and they just quietly went away. They, like, Paul and I went to Stone Roses gig there a few years ago, and it, like, they were shocking. It was just terrible.
But Tom, I just on that, I got to see the Stone Roses as well. And as someone who wasn't, who was barely born when the Stone Roses were first around, that was a massive moment for me as a music fan.
Yeah, and no, it was, yeah.
I also never got to see Oasis live because they split up just as I was probably old enough to get to go to see a gig by myself. So if you think about the younger generation who still are into that kind of music, granted, there's not that many, but it would be a massive thing.
It would be a massive statement, but I think, like, artistically, I'm not sure it would be worth it for them. Obviously, commercially, it would be, it's a no-brainer. They'd be, if they're not already sorted for life, which I know they both are, they will be two or three times over after doing that.
Yeah, I agree. I think it would easily sell out, but I remember seeing Pixies when they came over and they've toured a few times, and just the chemistry on stage, I remember being Frank Black and Kim Deal, just like two complete strangers. I'd say it was separate tours, separate dressing rooms, you know, not even talking to each other on stage. So in a way, I would 100% get it. And as Colin said, it's the reason why you want to go see the Stone Roses and come back. I was lucky enough, actually, one of the first gigs I saw was Oasis. It was the one when Liam pulled out with laryngitis, and it was just Noel doing the acoustic set. And it was brilliant. It was absolutely brilliant. I don't know. I'd be on the, I'd like to see it just to say the two of them together, but I don't think anything could live up to what you'd hype it as, to be honest.
Yeah, it would be interesting to see. Anyway, I know the Rolling Stones, for a lot of their tours over the last couple of about 20 years or so, Keith Richards wrote in his book that Mick Jagger and himself and the rest of the band, they basically tour in separate buses, stay in separate dressing rooms, barely talk anymore. But that's down to just a relationship that was so long that eventually it just had to, something had to give in that as well. But I know there's supposed to be a sports show and a football show. There was a great tweet about this from Richard Conway saying, Oasis have a new song out. I'm legally not allowed to go to the pub, and everyone is excited to see what players Newcastle United might sign this summer. Have I woken up in 1995? And I think that pretty much sums up where we are.
Yeah,
he's coming back to the Premier League, is he?
if people could actually see Colin Buig right now, which they can't. He's wearing a mad, colourful Adidas classic jacket, I think it is. And if anybody was able to see me, they'd see that my hair has grown.
Throw on your camera, Enda, please.
It's getting out of hand at this stage. So we very much are back to the simplicity of the 90s.
We should have Parkas next time. We can do this. It'd be great. Like Ian Brown haircuts and everything.
For now, we shall leave the music chat to the professionals, and we shall return to football chat after the break as I chat to Brendan Bradley from the former Finn Harps player, the leading goal scorer of all time in the League of Ireland. But lads, thanks very much for joining me, and hopefully over the next couple of weeks we might be able to catch up again if there are any more further B-sides that Noel happens to stumble upon.
Bye, my friend, I'm leaving.
This evening is Brendan Bradley, the most prolific striker in League of Ireland history. I made the mistake of saying one of the most prolific strikers when I sent out a tweet selling ahead to this, and I was quickly reminded by Finn Harris fans that he is, in fact, the top goal scorer of all time in the League of Ireland. Brendan, thanks very much for taking the call.
Right, Dan, it's a pleasure.
How are you keeping?
Oh, it's all right. You know, it gets a bit boring, but I try and get out for maybe half an hour every day, and it's just a terrible time for everybody, but I think we'll get over it.
Are you in Derry or Balbuffet?
I'm in Derry, Enda.
And is the situation in Derry kind of similar to what it is in the Republic?
Yeah, it's the same, I think, all over. The town's just completely, you know, dead. No shops open and no life about it, so it's going to take a big push to get everything going again. So it is.
We'll take you back to the very beginning in Derry City. You grew up in Derry. What was your football beginnings?
Well, I first started to play for the school team. I always wanted to play with an organised. I always played in the street, Enda, but I always wanted to have an organised match, you know, with jerseys, football jerseys, and that happened at school. The the sports schoolmaster picked me for the school team, and he thought I was a centre half, and he played me centre half for the school team, and then was moved under the middle of field by a man called Jim O'Hay. He used to run a junior team in Derry. We played in the Derry and District, and he moved me under the middle of field, you know. I played there then and signed for Derry City in about 1966, I think.
And was that a big moment for you?
Well, it was, because I was always going to the matches, you know, and you were watching the likes of Faye Coyle and Jimmy McGill and Dougie Wood and, you know, all these players, Johnny McKenzie, the Scotsman. They had a really great side then, and they won the Irish League. And that was a great thing to do then, because Linfield were won it year after year, and you had to be a really great team to wrench it away from Linfield, and they did that, you know.
Yeah. And
so to be asked to sign for them, like, you were in the same dressing room as these. They were my heroes, you know, football heroes, and you were in the same dressing room as them. So I played for the reserves mostly, and the manager, he played me out wide, you know, like the old outside right, they used to call it.
Yeah.
I was sort of very thin then. I was sort of thin made up, and he must have been trying to keep me out of the road of all the rough stuff, you know.
And at that stage, did you feel you were better than what you were playing at? Did you think that you were good enough for the first team?
Not really then. And I was only about 16, going on to 17 then, you know. And as I say, he played me out wide, and you were going to these grounds around the Irish League, you know, Glen Torrens ground and Distillery and Bangor and Ards, and there was hardly anybody at the matches. You know, you got a very small crowd going to the matches. But no, at 17, I never thought it was... I just loved playing football, and I was glad to be playing for... or to sign for Derry City, and even though it was a reserve team, you know, I said to myself, well, I'd have to wait a couple of years, to maybe 19 or 20, before, you know, you're able to make the first team.
And there's a lot of talk these days about the best bargain signings, and you yourself have to go down as one of those when Finn Harp signed you for £100 in 1969. What is the what's Finn Harp's looking like at that stage? Because they're still quite a new club at that period of time.
As you know, they got into the league in 69, and I was about 19, 20 then, and I had played about four or five times for Derry City in the Irish League. I scored one goal, and I was playing a match in Bunkrana. I sort of lost interest in playing for Derry Reserves. I wanted to try and get on, you know, to push on to the first team, but it wasn't happening at the time, and I was playing a Summer Cup match in Bunkrana, and after the match, somebody said, there's a man outside, wants to see you, Brian. So I went out, and it was Patsy McGowan. And he says, Brian, would you sign for Finn Harps? Where, you know, he was building a team at that time, building a team. Each player was picked. Patsy was picking players in Derry for certain positions. And I think at the time, he might have been looking for a striker, you know. Him and Bobby Towan was at the match. And Patsy seen something that day at the, you know, they thought I was good enough, you know. Bobby came round and says, well, I don't see anything, Patsy, you know, but Patsy says, I've seen me centre forward. So this was me he was talking about.
Yeah.
He asked me to sign for Harps, and I says, well, you can go and see the manager, Derry City, Patsy, and work something out. And Patsy came up to the house one night and says, you know, what happened? They had offered £100 to Jimmy Hull, the Derry City manager. Patsy says, I'm interested in Brenton. He says, and Jimmy Hull says, well, he sort of lost interest at the minute, and he says, I don't think he'll ever be a player, you know. So Patsy signed me for £100.
Yeah, it's a big signing it was too at the time. One of the more interesting points about Finn Harps is that this is obviously their first year in the league, and 4 days before Finn Harps play their first game, the British Army are deployed into Derry for the first time during the Troubles.
Yeah.
Were you, growing up in Derry, obviously you had to travel between Derry and Balbuffet for training, and there would have been quite a link with the two cities, especially how close the likes of Bunkrana is to Derry and the Derry border. What was that like for you as a player?
And you never thought about it. We just met up on a Sunday in Derry, the team, and we headed out the Letterkenny Road, and the army checkpoint was there, and I think they sort of checked, they would stop the car sometimes, and other times they wouldn't, and check the driver, whoever was driving, check their license, and waved us on. So we had no real bother that way, you know. They stopped me coming back from a match once, you know, and they went down with my license, and I said to the wife, I think there's something wrong here today, you know. And then two of them came out, and two of the soldiers, and they says, Mr. Bradley, under the Special Powers Act, he says, we're arresting you, you know. And, but that was happening a lot of times around, you know, the north. They were checking people out, and you know.
How did you get out of that situation, or did anything ever come of that, or what happened after?
They took me up to the army camp, but they called it Piggery Ridge, you see, above Craigan. And I was only up there for about an hour, you know, and asked me a few questions and whatnot, but they let me go then. So I just drove on home again. But as I say, it happened pretty regular around the north, Derry and Belfast and other places then, you know. But we had no real power passing the checkpoints, you know, going to training or matches, and you know.
Yeah, it's crazy how something right now that seems that just seems like madness at this time of being, but I suppose it was normality for a lot of people at that time.
That's right. You just got used to it, and as I say, maybe they got the nose going over the past the checkpoint every other week, you know, going to Ballybofey. No, that wasn't really a problem, to tell you the truth. So it wasn't, you know.
One of the interesting things that Patsy McGowan, who was quite an outspoken manager, said when Finn Harper first led into the league, I know it wasn't an easy decision, or some people weren't happy with Finn Harper getting into the league in the first place, was that they would be playing in Europe within 5 years.
Yeah.
And in the build-up to that, you obviously have a couple of runs at the Cup, and it comes to the four in 1974 when you get an FAI Cup final. What are your memories of that game?
Oh, the final, that was something special, you know, because, as I say, Harps joined in 69, and a lot of people thought that it was a mistake because, well, Fun Park was, it wasn't really developed, you know, they put a stand up later on, but, you know, it was just the bare necessities end of them. So, as I say, Patsy was building a team, and 1974 we got to the Cup Final. I remember it like it was yesterday. There must have been 12,000 Fun Harp supporters there. Like, he just couldn't have lost that day. I remember Tony O'Doherty saying, we can't lose this match today, boys, you know. And we were playing St. Patrick's Athletic. We won 3-1, and it was pretty even up to the last 10 or 15 minutes, and we got the two late goals, and 2-1, you know, it was still, I got the equaliser, but we got the third in, and I think that finished the match, you know. They weren't going to come back then, so it was a great day and great celebrations afterwards, you know.
Yeah, and Charlie Ferry obviously scored the opening goal in that game before St. Pat's equalised, and you scored the two winning goals, but I suppose the main context of this game would be that a teammate of yours, Jim McDermott, was killed by a falling tree while driving the team minibus in January of that year. So would you, yeah. You obviously would have been aware of this, how big a moment that would have been for him to be part of that team. So yeah. Would that have played a big role in the way you set up that day?
Yeah. Jim played in the first match, and the first round match against, I think it was Home Farm. We won 4-1. I remember it was a very bad, it was a windy day. It was windy during the match, but as we were going home, it was getting sort of worse, you know, and that night in Derry was very bad, and the tree came down just outside where Jim lives, out on the main road, and Jim was leaving babysitter's home, and the tree had come down, you know. It was sort of just a bit above. Jim was driving a minibus, you know, and whatever happened anyway, Jim ran under the tree, and that's how Jim got killed. But Patsy was saying before the match, boys, remember, let's win it for Jim McDermott. It was very, very sad because Jim would have really enjoyed that day, the victory. You know, he was only 23 or 4, I think, at the time, and, you know.
And would you have been emotional after the game, thinking about him?
Well, we were. Jim was a big part of the team. He was there from the first match, so he was a very, very good player. He's strong. He would hold the ball up, and he wouldn't get the ball. Once Jim got the ball, you wouldn't get the ball off him. You know, he was that strong and great left foot. And it's hard to believe. I remember my mother-in-law coming on the day after, and it was the morning, and she says, the morning after the home farm match, and she says, there's a Van Herbst player killed last night. And I says, only, what do you call him? She says, I think his name's McDermott. And I knew right away when she says McDermott, about who, you know, there was only one McDermott played. It was Jim.
And when you do win this game, that, like I said, Patsy McGowan said that you would be in Europe, that would... This gives you a chance to play in Europe as well, and Van Herbst travel over to Bursaspor in Turkey, which a lot of the people I've spoken to over the past series have travelled to far beyond worlds, and I suppose Turkey at that stage would have been similar enough to that.
Oh, this is it was a big thing for us to get into Europe, and as I say, we were only on the league about 4 or 5 years, you know, and surprising everybody. And we were due against Bursa, and we were beaten 4-1 out in Bursa, and it was a draw, like 1-1 at home. They put us out anyway, you know, in the first match. So they did. I think we'd actually played Aberdeen too. I think Aberdeen might have been the first match we played in Europe, you know.
And what was it like travelling to Turkey at that stage? Because this would have been the 70s before the Iron Curtain came down and Eastern Europe was still split up from Western Europe. So to be a club the size of Finn Harps travelling to that kind of country, what was that feeling like?
Well, it was a big adventure for the players, you know, and everybody enjoyed it. As I say, it was a big adventure, but the night of the match, like, there was a lot of these police with white helmets on, and I was saying to myself, God, they must be going to expect a bit of trouble, but I don't know who was going to cause the trouble, because there was very few Van Herbst supporters there, Andy, you know?
Yeah.
But they looked at me a bit like riot police. But I always remember this coach we were on, travelling, I don't know what part of the journey it was, but we were in this coach, and... every time we stopped, this boy got out and put a big wage on the outside of the, you know, like a, it was like a do-it-yourself handbrake, you know, put the big wage under the wheel, you know, outside.
Yeah.
And something you never seen before, like, but everybody enjoyed it, you know, and even though we were beaten, the players then were, you know, they really enjoyed the trip, so they did.
A couple of years later, you're... form for Van Herbst is obviously brilliant, scoring loads of goals, and the opportunity arises to go over to Lincoln City. Did you enjoy that, or was it a difficult period for you? How did you find moving across to England?
Well, I never thought about going to England, and Patsy, it started with David Hare, just to play with Waterford, with Jimmy McGill. I used to play with Man United, and he got the Lincoln City manager's job, and they signed Jimmy from Waterford, and they must have been looking for a striker. And Jimmy mentioned my name, you know, he mentioned my name, and the first thing that I seen Patsy and Fran coming to the door one day, and Jimmy had got, or David Haird had gotten touch with him. They wanted to sign me, you know, so... I went over to Lincoln, and I was over for a season. Just I scored something like 12 or 13 goals, you know, but never really settled over there. And
would you have found that the standard was higher at that stage, or did you enjoy that aspect of it?
It was much like the League of Ireland, so it was. It wasn't a great standard, but I would say it was maybe slightly better, just maybe than the League of Ireland. And I remember Graham Tugger, he went on to become England manager. Graham was right back at the time in the team, you know. And he actually took over. David Haird got the sack, and Graham took over as manager. Graham went on to great things then, as you know. He went to Watford, and then he went on to manage the English and England national team, you know. Like once the goal's dried up, I sort of, I know, I got a bit of homesickness, and I ended up coming home. I was happy coming home, but you see, you hear these, I heard then that Spurs were interested in you and interested in signing you, but when I was over there, nothing happened, you know. So I ended up coming back, and I was happy coming back at the time, and I had a great, great career in the League of Ireland afterwards, you know.
Yeah, and you re-signed for Finn Harps, and you also spent a little bit of time in the American Football League with Toronto. What was that experience like?
Got a phone call during the season was over, somebody from Toronto, and they were looking for somebody to play up front, you know. So I went over there for, it wasn't very long, it was about 3 or 4 months, I think it was. I enjoyed it. Eusebio was on the team, the great Eusebio. Played for Portugal during the 66 World Cup, you know. Mm-hmm. Couldn't believe it, you know. Mm. But he was nearly finished then. He had a few injuries, and they were starting to tell on him, you know. But he got a chance. He could still score, no bother to him, you know.
And would he have spoken much English at that point? Did you get chatting to him about the experiences he had in his career?
No, he wasn't really good at speaking English. And, you know, they seemed to be a group of them were talking Portuguese, you know.
In terms of football, in terms of what was the standard in America at that stage? Because there were quite a number of players, the likes of Pelé, the likes of George Best, Franz Beckenbauer played for the Cosmos as well. Was the standard any good at that stage, or was it just getting off the ground?
It had started a few years earlier, I think, and no, the standard was pretty good. As you say, there was a lot of these players, George Best, and I think Rodney Marsh was out. I noticed a few of them playing. Best came to our ground one night. He was playing for Los Angeles. As you say, all these stars that were finished playing in England and around the world were, you know, they were getting good money to come out to America, and they were helping to develop the game, you know, Enda.
Yeah, and so did you play against George Best then?
No, it was so bad night, actually, Enda, but he came to Toronto, Los Angeles, I think he was playing for, you know.
And what was he like at that stage in his career?
He was still a great dribbler. He always had that talent, as everybody knows, he's been a great dribbler, you know, and he could take people along and go past them. Maybe he didn't do it as well. Then he hadn't got the sharpness, and maybe his lifestyle was, you have to have lifestyle if you're going to stay at the top, you know, as he did it with Manchester United. Maybe it just wasn't the same then, you know.
As I mentioned, you're the highest scorer in League of Ireland history, and everywhere you went, Athlone Town, Sligo Rovers, and Derry City as well, you scored many, many goals for each club. Was that all instinct, or were you on the training ground after games and after training practicing, or what made you such a special goal scorer?
No, I never done any extra training at all, and just. That must have been a natural thing. So I had a good instinct and my reflex, you know, it was anything that fell around the box there. As I say, I had a good instinct and I was pretty sharp on it. And if I got a chance, well, didn't score all the time, but I scored a good few, you know. No, I didn't do any extra work shooting or stuff like that. And as I say, it must have been just a natural thing, and I was happy playing for Finn Harps, really happy, and the goals just kept coming. And Patsy moved down to Sligo then. I was down there 3 years. I scored 45 to 50, I think, down there in 3 seasons. So no, I was just happy where I was in the League of Ireland and really enjoying it, you know, and that's a big part of it. So it is.
And a lot of people who hold goal scoring records in different leagues would be the penalty taker, but I'm right in saying that you weren't Finn Harps' penalty taker at the time.
No, I only talk about 4, so I've had my whole career. Charlie was the penalty taker, and Charlie had a great left foot and he hardly ever missed, so I didn't take the penalties at all. I talk about 4, as I say, in my whole career, and I think I missed one of them, so when you look at the total goals, I think it's 309 all in all competitions in the League of Ireland, you know. So they score that many without depending on a lot of penalties, you know, it's pretty good.
Yeah, it's not bad now. Why didn't you hit the penalties? If most strikers would be selfish in that point.
No, I never even thought of it. And that, and you know, as you say, some strikers would like to take the penalties. They boost their total number of goals. But Charlie just was a penalty taker. He was known for it, and I never bothered. I just never thought about it. You know, I could have went to Patsy and says, "Patsy, can I take the penalties or whatever?" But no, I never bothered. Just let Charlie get on me, slotting them in.
What was Patsy like as a manager? Because he's a revered character in Donegal football, and he spent most of his life working in and around Finn Harps, be that as a manager or working in the board as well. So he must have had something about him. Was he tactical, or was he a man manager, or did he have it all?
Patsy was great for me, and because he seen me playing, and he thought, as I say, I could do a job for him. And Patsy would be doing everything about Finn Harps in them days, as far as I could see. He drove us to the matches in the money bus, and he used to be flying down the road, you know. He was a great driver. He was a driving instructor, you know. And from 1969, Patsy built a great side. In the 70s, we had a really great side, and each year he improved it. He picked the players that he wanted. He got Peter Hutton for left back, and he got Declan McDowell, and beside Jim Sheridan, and signed Jerry McGranahan, then right back, you know, a really good back four. He brought Tony O'Doherty to the middle of the field, you know, great players. Mm-hmm. He signed big Hulry Carlisle up front to play up front with me, you know. And he left Finn Harps with a really great side in the 70s, and it was all down to Patsy, you know.
Would that side have been good enough to win the league? Did you slightly underachieve?
We underachieved, certainly, I think, you know. It was our own fault, and I wouldn't blame Patsy that way. The players were to blame, because, you know, it was the teams that were in maybe the bottom half of the table that was taking points of us, you know. And at the end of the season, then the thing, it just didn't happen for us, because we were letting these teams take points off us, and we were doing better against the teams in the top three or four, you know. But it was the bottom teams that we finished runners-up in the league three times, I think, in the 70s. So, I mean, that was great for a team that only came into the league in 1969. We won the Cup and the Dublin City Cup as well. So we had a great side in the 70s. You know, I think it was the best time. The crowds were great. So they were really big matches against Cork Cubs and Waterford, teams like that, you know, and Shamrock Rovers. Really great atmosphere at Fun Park.
Yeah, because I'm from Donegal, and I would have been sort of brought up on stories about Finn Harps well, and some of the teams from back in the day. And really and truly, I haven't really gotten to see Finn Harps do anything other than survive in the League of Ireland over the last couple of years. So it would have been brilliant to watch the team of the 70s and see how good a team from Donegal could be, because it is a great footballing county.
Yeah. No, it was a great mixture of Derry and Donegal fellas, you know, and they were all, as I say, teams were actually afraid coming up to play us, I would say. You know, Eddie Mahon had played for Derry City and Finn Harps and a few other teams. He says he went down to Athlone, you know, and he says whenever he was playing in goals for them, and whenever we were coming down to play them, or they were coming up to Finn Park, he says they were petrified, you know. Mm-hmm. He didn't realise it, you know, until he was actually in the dressing room and seeing boys talking about, you know, they were really worried about who they had he marked and whatnot, you know.
Of all 300 odd goals you scored for Finn Harps, is there one that stands out for you? Is it the two that you scored in the FAI Cup final, or is there one that was particularly good in your opinion?
Well, the two in the Cup final was special, you know, but the best goal I think I scored was against Shelburne, just after I came back from Lincoln. It was a three ball Terry Hargan played, and Paddy Roach was in nets. He used to play with, he played for Man United later on in his career. It was a three ball, and I hooked it over his head, you know, over Paddy Roach's head, the goalkeeper, and just as that, the fullback was coming in from the side to try and clear it, and I flicked it over his head too, you know. The ball hadn't hit the ground, followed it under the empty goal then, you know. So I thought that was the best goal I ever scored.
Yeah, it's a pity a lot of these goals aren't readily available, like most goals from the modern era. In terms of modern Finn Harps, have you been following them in the last couple of years under Ollie Horgan?
Yeah, I got to know that match yet, and that's what I do. But my biggest regret is that, you know, the League of Ireland now is getting a great coverage every week, you know, and the goals are getting shown. And I was saying to me, I was just thinking one night, like, very few of the goals, all the goals that I scored were actually, there was no coverage then on television.
Yeah.
So there wasn't, and I just thought it would have been nice to sit down and see the goals that you scored, you know, but it's just one of them things.
You obviously miss football then, do you? Miss playing it?
I still miss it, and but sure, every footballer is the same, you know. When you're finished, that's it, and play day was nearly 38, so that was pretty old for a striker to stay to that age, you know. Nowadays, if you're, unless you're very, very good, like, if you're playing up front now at 33 or 4, they sort of, much as say that you're finished, you shouldn't be on as much, they say, you know.
Mm. Do you think anybody will ever break your record?
I think maybe in the future, somebody, maybe, they're playing more matches now, Andy, you know. For 10 years, we only played 26 games then, you know, in the season, in the league, and they're playing, I think it's about 36 now, you know, so if somebody was scoring pretty regular, maybe they would get near it, you know, with the extra matches, and somebody maybe scores a lot of penalties. As I say, I never took penalties, but somebody that would build their total up with penalties might get near enough at the end, you know.
Yeah, well, until then, it's your record to hold anyway, and something that Finn Harps fans will definitely be proud of until somebody eventually does break it, if it does happen. Brendan, thanks very much for taking the call. You've been brilliant with your time as well.
Thanks very much, Sandra.
So that's about all we have time for on Team 33 tonight. Thanks very much for listening. If you want to listen back to any of that show, go to offtheball.com/podcast. Find us in the OTB podcast network. We'll be back again next week with some more LOI legends and maybe some more Oasis chat. Who knows? They might release another song in the next week or so. I have my doubts. But fingers crossed, anything can happen in this crazy world. You can also find any of our stuff on Spotify, on iTunes. Like, subscribe, give us 5 stars, regardless of whether you think we are worthy of your 5 stars, just hit that 5 stars. You can find all of our stuff on our Twitter channel as well, at Team33, that's spelled out in all words, or you can also find us on Off the Ball as well. I hope everyone is staying safe and staying healthy out there. But until next week, take it away, Johan.